gentlemen, welcome to episode 47 of the Reform Pubcast, your weekly podcast where we never let go and let God for fear of spilling our beer, because we would, drop it because we wouldn't have a tight, you know. I'm your mysterious host, Les.
And I'm your insane host, Tanner.
Insane host?
Yes.
Okay, so here's the deal. I'm going to disclose some mystery that's been going on. Last week, while we were recording the show, Tanner brought up to me that Joey Daniels had posted some pictures in the pub of our original pint glasses. And they had, somehow, they had Heisenberg's face frosted into them after he'd frozen them, frozen them in the freezer. And it turns out that Lauren Elizabeth Weekly is the person who originally found it. And then some other people throughout this week have found Heisenberg in their glasses as well. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to let all of you in on what was going on, this crazy conspiracy. And here's the truth. We have no freaking clue what the heck happened. That's what's up.
That's the truth. It appears that maybe they like repurposed our glasses.
So yeah. So as we were recording, Tanner mentioned it to me, and I totally played it off like oh yeah, we did that, because I thought that somebody else was playing a joke on the pub to begin with, like it was all a hoax, and I was just playing into it because I didn't have time to investigate it. But as more people have put up pictures and put up videos, even it's become abundantly clear that the manufacturer of our glasses somehow has Heisenberg's face embedded in a limited number of those original glasses that were sent out. So if you haven't put your glass in the freezer to see if freezing it reveals Heisenberg's face, which is the coolest sentence I've ever said in my life, if you haven't done that yet, do it, because it might be in there. And if you have one of those glasses, then you are like the elect within the elect, and and now you have like this super collectible, I don't know, you know, whatever.
But love that you used the elect within the elect. It's really good.
But it's super rare, because I have two glasses and neither of them have Heisenberg's face. So I actually wish I had one of these awesome things. And it's ironic because, you know, our first episode we devoted like half an hour to talking about Breaking Bad. And we have made ourselves, you know, it's pretty clear that Tanner and I both absolutely love Breaking Bad. And it just so happened that these mugs somehow ended up with this ghostly image of Heisenberg in them. That's amazing.
I'm gonna go ahead and believe that that the person who printed our glasses
listens
is a huge fan of the cast, or just listened to it when they saw us submit our artwork. And was like, here's a little Easter egg for these guys.
I like
and
it.
And they, yeah. I mean, like some invisible ink or something on there. Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know why they would spend the time cleaning off, like repurposing glasses. I imagine the process of cleaning off that screen printing ink is probably more time consuming than just printing on new glasses. Because I'm sure whoever the manufacturer is for our glasses probably gets the glasses cheap. And like it's probably cost more than just throwing them out. So I like to think that it was something they did for us.
Well, I saw some investigative work in the group, and people found a picture of that exact same glass on the exact, like the exact same print on the exact same glass, and it's in with black ink, and they sell it at Spencer's Gifts. So Spencer's Gifts probably produces tons of those glasses, and somewhere in the factory, like some of them were either prepped for printing or they stripped some of the ink off after they printed them and reused them. But the coincidence is ridiculous because we totally love the show. And now you all have to give us credit, because we totally could have just claimed that as genius. But I actually think that the truth is stranger than the fiction. Like that's, I'm still blown away that even happened. It's so crazy.
Yeah. It's, I was very excited when I thought that maybe you had pulled like an invisible ink scheme or something and hadn't told me about it.
I wish I had.
Yeah. So, Les, I want to talk a little bit about the definition of insanity and relate it back to something, I guess, a little deep in my own life. So, I think we've all heard that definition that Albert Einstein threw out for insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And I don't know about you, man, but this is something that... I think defines me in a lot of ways with my interaction with the Lord. I tend to trust to like way too much in myself. So like, you know, as I've talked about a lot lately, like I'm in med school and it's very, demanding, time consuming, stressful, you know, so, you know, I kind of, you know, when I started med school, I recognize that I'm here because the Lord's brought me here, that he's sovereign and he's called me to this, and I feel called to this, to pursue medicine and to take care of people. So, you know, when I first started med school, I was, you know, very serious about, you know, every day getting in the Word and making sure that I was recognizing that God is the one who's brought me here, that he's the one who sustains me here. You know, any knowledge that I have is by his grace and mercy. Anything that I'm capable of doing with my hands and my mind are all of him. And as time, you know, has kind of gone on in this module, and as things have gotten more demanding, I've you know, really kind of just basically been like, man, I don't have time for that. Like, I gotta get studying, get in the material. Like, any minute I'm not studying, I'm not learning things and you know, preparing for my final, because pretty much in med school, like a lot of college classes, well, I guess not college, most college, like undergraduate stuff has multiple tests, but in med school, like you have a final and that's pretty much it. Like I had a midterm, but it's only worth 15% of the grade, and it's just to kind of like gauge where you're at in the material and kind of direct your studying. So my final is worth everything, and so it's a lot of stress, especially the school that I'm attending. You know, like the whole, like, a lot of people say like C equals MD, not at the school I'm going to. If you get multiple C's in a row, they actually put you up for review. You're on academic probation. And if you don't improve, they'll expel you. So, passing, technically C is passing, but, like not by their standards. So, that's a lot of pressure because a lot of people get C's in med school. It's very difficult. I mean, I come, you know, as an undergraduate, I never got anything but like an A. I got a C on a couple tests, but you know, I was a straight A student. And so getting, you know, wrapping my brain around the fact of getting C's is causes a lot of stress. And, so I've really been neglecting my time in the Word. I've been neglecting, you know, my prayer life and just, trusting in the Lord completely for everything, for my ability to have successful studying, to be successful on my tests, to be successful as a physician one day, and really just been, you know, kind of just like I make, you know, the whole like I make my own destiny. I've got to work. I've got to do this. And you know, I took my midterm, and I didn't fail my midterm, but I didn't do well on my midterm. I didn't do great. You know, it's nostalgic for me to be in the position that I'm in right now, because this has happened to me in my life many times where it happened with me when I took MCAT. Like I took the MCAT and I didn't do well, and I got really anxious and got really like distraught. And it was like, all of a sudden I started thinking like, you know, like this is part of how God calls me back to him, that he reminds me who's in control. He reminds me that without him, I'm nothing. I can't do this on my own. And he uses many things in my life, but, in the past it's been money, you know, where we, you know, we've been on our last dollar and I've had to just completely depend on the Lord. And lately, in the last couple of years, it's been my grades. And, for some reason, I continue to repeat this trend of like trusting in myself. The Lord like smacks me and says, "Who do you think you are? You know, do you really think you can do this on your own? Do you really think that, like, without me, without trusting in me, like, I'm going to bless this. I'm going to sustain this. Like, if your eyes aren't on me, you're going to sink. You're going to sink in the water. And so, I don't know, man. I just wanted to, like, kind of talk about that a little bit and, like, get your thoughts. Like, if you've ever been in this situation in your life, like, how the Lord has, chastised you, like, with things like this. Because it seems to be something that I keep doing, and I know the formula. Like, I know what the, like, I know how... I know how to live as a Christian. And I know what I'm supposed to do, and I know who I'm supposed to trust in. I know who I'm supposed to get all my worth in, and I continue to fall down and trust in myself, and then fail miserably, and then I get back in the Word. I start trusting the Lord again, and then He just blesses me immensely, and reminds me that I'm in control. You're not the one, like, who's capable of answering these questions. You're not the one who's capable of doing these things. Without me, you're nothing. And I don't know, man. Like, it's just, for some reason, I can't learn my lesson. I keep doing this over and over again.
Yeah, dude. That's, I don't know. Like, there's a part of me that wants to say, like, it's crazy that you say that because, you know, I'm going through something like that right now, too. But, like, that's the amazing thing that we've all learned by this point, if we've been a Christian for any amount of time, is, like we know that this religion is absolutely true because of how universal this experience is, of how dependent we actually are on God. And, like, everything you're saying, I guarantee every single person listening, like, is nodding their head the whole time. Like, yes, like, dry season... And it's all, like, the dry seasons that are completely dependent on my, refusal to just seek God. Just go to Him and get down on my face before Him. And I just won't do it because I'm too busy and I'm so I need this strength right now. And I need every single last bit of time to make all the things in my life work. And in the back of our mind, there's this nagging voice telling us, like, no, what are you doing? Like, you don't have the strength to do this. You need to get before the Lord, and He is your source of strength. And somehow, even through that, He's, like, graciously still providing for us, even though we know that we're wrong. And then eventually, it just all becomes too much, and we, like, collapse before Him, and we find Him to be perfectly gracious and everything that we knew we needed the whole time. And we even feel that peace immediately. And then, like, you know, the actual things that we need are sustained. All the things that we've been stressing over and like grinding toward, it's like he just reminds us, like, stop. It's me. I'm going to do this for you, and you're going to walk in my strength. And that doesn't take away our responsibility. It doesn't do anything like that. But when we actually walk in accord with, like, the calling that we have, everything just actually works, and it's like a well-oiled spiritual machine. He's, like, working in us as we work, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think it all boils down to, like, it's so, I don't know, man, it gives me chills to think about, like, as children of God, his relationship with us is so different than the rest of the world, where he desires us to be completely dependent on Him. And also, you know, as His children, like, He wants us, when we succeed at things on earth, you know, He wants us to understand completely that we only succeeded because of Him. And if I was successful on my own, in my own methods, I would give myself credit. You know, this is why we're reformed. I mean, this comes back to our salvation when we think about, like, we contribute nothing to our salvation, like, zero, zilch. And it's because the Lord wants all of the glory because He deserves all the glory. Like even if I was successful, like, people who are successful who aren't children of God, like, they're only successful because God is the one allowing them to be successful. And as His children, our relationship is so different, and that he wants us to recognize that he is the one doing it, and he will have it no other way. And it's interesting because I was, you know, like when I get in these times, I automatically, like, I immediately start preaching the gospel to myself and start reading the Psalms. And I just started from the top on the Psalms, and I started reading through. And when I got to Psalm 2, and I know, like, Psalm 2 more applies to, like, secular nations and stuff, but it's still, like, the Lord still used it to speak to me in, like, a way of, like, just displaying, like, how silly I am in my own ways. And I just want to read, like, just a little bit of Psalm 2, and we've all heard it, but I just want to read it. It says, why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. The one enthroned in heaven laughs, and the Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask me, and I will make the nations your inheritance and ends of the earth your possessions. And, like, I obviously, like I said, I know that this is talking more about people, like, warring against the Lord, but it the thing that really spoke to me is that, like, God is laughing at my vain, like, plans. Like, he, even as his child, he looks at me, and I'm, you know, studying 8 hours a day, and I'm, like, running through these slides and making notes and making flashcards and doing everything I can, and he's just, like, laughing at this, at the fact that I could just depend on him and he's going to take care of me. Whether that means success in medicine or whatever, it doesn't, that's not the point. The point is that me striving on my own without looking to him for the strength to do it is utterly foolish, silly, and just, it's ridiculous, because he promises to take care of me, promises to give me everything I need, and I still, like, try to do it on my own when I can. It's like you have kids, man. My kid trying to go in the kitchen and make, like, a grilled cheese sandwich at 3 years old, like, he would make a mess, and it would be like, it wouldn't be a good grilled cheese sandwich. He'd probably burn himself, and like, he could just ask me, and I could give him his food. I could make his food for him, and it would be perfect, and it would be enjoyable, and he wouldn't burn himself, and he wouldn't, you know, but as, like, we're so much like little children that we think we can do everything on our own, and we just end up burning ourselves and making a mess, and the result is crap, and it's unedible, and all we have to do is look at our Lord and say, Lord, just take care of this for me. Like, I will keep my hands busy. I will, you know, I'll still go to work. I won't be a sloth, but you direct my hands. You do everything, and I'm just going to keep them busy, and you're going to produce with them.
Amen.
And, man, like, I don't know why I keep doing this, but it's super frustrating. And I don't know, hopefully with age, as I get wiser, and the Lord just continues to, you know, make me wiser. Like, I just pray that he'll get me out of this trend where I just continually trust in myself and not in him. It's just, I pray for that day, because it would just be such a great peace that I could have over me to just, like, just let him direct my steps and me not try to direct my own steps.
Yeah. Yeah, man, that's just that amazing. Like, I don't know, every time I feel stressed and I actually get the chance to think about what I'm doing, it's just like, stress is stupid.
Yeah.
You are toiling for things that you don't need to toil for, because
they mean nothing.
and he will take care of it. Like, he dresses the lilies, he feeds the birds. Like, he will take care of you. Stop stressing. I'm in the same place as you. You know, like, when will we learn our lesson? And I don't think we ever fully will until glory. Tanner, what are you drinking, buddy?
I started off with my super clear homebrew of that cream ale. Man, it is clearing up nice. It's super drinkable. It's light and refreshing and crisp for summer. And I have moved on to Saison Dubuff, which is part of the gift package that we got from Dogfish Head.
Yeah.
This beer was a collaboration between Stone, your favorite brewery.
Yeah.
Victory and Dogfish. And it's a Saison, which I love. But it also has parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme in it, which I think is really cool because like farmhouse beers, like Saisons, were like farmers would just throw whatever they had laying around in the beer. And I kind of feel like it's a callback to that time. And it's very good. I feel like that I could never do this because if I added these ingredients, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, I know that I would either not do enough or I would overdo it and it would probably be not drinkable. But I'm sure it took a couple batches to get it right. But I'm really impressed with it. I usually don't like things with stuff like this in it and beer, but it adds a nice it's almost like how hops add like floral notes and stuff to it.
Yeah.
They actually just use because there's hops that give you like a parsley taste or a rosemary taste or whatever, but they actually just use the straight ingredients and it's really good. It adds like that hop floral character without actually using hops. I mean, I'm sure they used hops as well, but I'm just, you know, and it's bravo. That's all I can say. Bravo. Very good job using those ingredients in a beer.
Awesome. I'm having an awesome beer I've never had before from Sierra Nevada. And speaking of Sierra Nevada, I'm getting very, very excited about my new Christmas tradition, which is drinking Sierra Nevada Celebration.
Oh, yes.
Can't wait.
Yes.
But right now I'm having Blindfold Black IPA from Sierra Nevada, and it is awesome. What an awesome beer. It's basically a stout, but it's definitely an IPA. It's amazing. Like,
awesome.
Dark, heavy IPA. Just delicious. So check out Blindfold Black awesome. IPA from Sierra Nevada.
Get ready for, you had mentioned Celebration. Also get ready for Founders Breakfast Stout.
Oh, yeah. When does that come out?
Coming out. It comes out in the winter. So it should be, I think, like November, December-ish time.
Yes.
So that is a very special time in my life when I can have breakfast stout. And Lagunitas Sucks is going to come out soon, which is also like a winter seasonal beer. So those are two really good beers that are seasonal that I look forward to.
Awesome. If you would like to contact us, you can join our Facebook group called The Reformed Pub, where we talk about beer and theology. You can join us on Twitter at Reformed Pubcast. You can email us reformedpub@gmail.com, and you can always leave us voicemails by calling 772-405-7327. We have a very special guest. I can't tell you how excited I am, but first, listen to this amazing song off of King's Kaleidoscope's first LP, Becoming Who We Are, which comes out October 27th. Check it out.
Every day a duck's got chased, the sunset, looking for a glimpse of heaven's skies. I've been given a taste for something that nothing in this world can satisfy. But I know that a time is coming when I will be in glorious delight. Chase the sunrise, looking for a hint of heaven's light. I've been given a taste for something that nothing in this world can satisfy. But I know that a time is coming when I will be in glorious.
the man behind King's Kaleidoscope, Chad Gardner. Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, man, this is exciting. Dude, I don't know if you know this, but you're a pretty talented musician, and and your music's pretty awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so first off, right off the bat, because I've never heard you answer this, I'm sure you've answered it a million times, but what does the name King's Kaleidoscope mean?
It actually means nothing. We had a million different band name ideas, and none of them felt right. And then one evening, while we were hanging out with some friends after a church service, you know, we were just, it was the same conversation of, we need a band name so bad, and one of our friends just popped off the top of his head, how about King's Kaleidoscope? And then it weaseled its way into the list, and about a month later, we were like, that's actually the best name we have. We just liked the way it sounded, so we kept it.
Yeah, it feels very meaningful.
That's, a lot of people think like it, you know, I think that's kind of fun, actually, is that people can kind of make it mean different things, and, you know, the only time that we've really gotten like into like, is there a meaning or not, is when we were trying to decide between an apostrophe or not. And it was like, well, if there's an apostrophe, you know, maybe it's like, you know, God's kaleidoscope of
right.
musicians. And like, it was like, I was like, no, apostrophe doesn't look as good. And I don't, it doesn't actually have a meaning. So it's fine. But then it was like, no, but then it's like yours. And well, anyway, we ditched the apostrophe and we didn't really care.
Yeah, it's funny how much time you spend like thinking of band names, and it's like it seems to be so important when you're in the band, yep. but for everybody else, like, I mean, think about like if you look through even like what music's coming out today, like most of the band names don't mean anything, or they're, if like, I would never name my band that.
Yeah.
But like they turn out like, it just, the music kind of speaks for itself for the most part.
Totally.
And you just don't, like, most people don't even really pay attention. If you're good, if it's good music, nobody really cares about the name.
Yeah, totally. So, and it I think there's, you know, there's like an aesthetic to it. It has like a youthful, like, I don't know. It just, it felt right, even though it didn't have necessarily a meaning, which, you know, it right. counts for something.
And it has that alliteration, and alliteration always.
exactly.
So we're big into theology on this year podcast.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite song off of Live in Color is, I think it's your favorite as well, Felix Culpa.
Mm.
And so we've talked a lot about, you know, God's sovereignty and how even the evil in the world is sort of a part of God's decree for his greater, beautiful, wonderful purposes and things like that. And I know from listening to some of your interviews, to put it lightly, you've had a rough year this yes. past year.
Yeah, definitely.
I was hoping maybe we could talk a little bit, just really get into like some theological discussion about that idea, Felix Culpa. Maybe you can even explain what that means and talk about what it means to you and what the doctrine means in general.
Yeah, totally. You know, that song was kind of born out of two different things that simultaneously happened. One was I had a pastor that I was, you know, talking to encourage me to write a song about the idea that you can glory in your sins being forgiven. And so I was kind of kicking that around on one, you know, one side of things in one conversation. And another conversation I was having with another pastor I was working with was, I was talking to him about that. And then he just said, oh, that sounds like this thing, Felix Culpa, which is Latin. And it means, fortunate fall or happy fall or lucky or blessed fall. And I mean, you can just Wikipedia it. That's what I did. But, It's a pretty incredible phrase because I think it, in just two words, kind of captures the whole idea that all of our sins are, you know, being saved and redeemed by Jesus. All of our sins are become examples of God's grace and His love for us. And so when we look at our sins, we can actually boast in them because they're forgiven. And instead of looking at them and just feeling the weight of how sinful we are, we can feel the depth and the weight of that sin, but it's at the exact same time, it's a weight and depth of God's grace for us. So it's a dual meaning, and it's kind of hard to get your head around, but it's also just really beautiful, and it's the gospel. And so writing lyrics for that song was really difficult. It was a hard topic to try to capture and to try to have the right emotion and stuff like that. And I wrote it with a few friends. I think it turned out pretty special.
Yeah. I really like to think about the idea that, because you know, we want to tie everything back to the glory of God. And, mm-hmm. Like there's this idea that, you know, God could have been glorified by sustaining and giving life to Adam and Eve in the garden. But, there is this idea of this blessed fall, in the idea that because Adam and Eve fell, now God is glorified not only as creator and sustainer, but now as savior.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to lift him high, and now we can look at our lives and say, these are the things that I've gone through, and Christ has redeemed, and now mm-hmm. he will be glorified that much more because he's a redeemer now. So good.
Yeah.
Could have gone the other way too. Like God would have been justified in just destroying the world and all of mankind at the first spark of sin from Adam.
Yeah.
But it's this beautiful thing where God has this overarching plan where he's going to bring even, he's going to show so much more glory by sacrificing himself. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting though, because like when you were saying that, Les and I have had lots of conversations about like just the conundrum that is the fact that we still sin mm-hmm. as regenerated people with new hearts and new desires, and you know, this conundrum that exists of like how do we view this sin, how do we not get depressed about it, how do we not be sad about it, and how do we rightfully respond to it in a way that is glorifying to the Lord, but in the same sense not make light of it and not see it as something that grace will just abound, right. and taking it lightly,
right?
And it's something that obviously Paul talked about a lot, even it's just
yeah.
continuing to do the things that he doesn't want to do, but not doing the things that he wants to do. And it's just like this, we now have this internal battle that didn't exist before, where we didn't really see anything wrong with sinning.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have this battle that goes on with our flesh and our heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that idea speaks to Christians everywhere, that I think every Christian
mm-hmm.
who loves Jesus and understands what he did, can relate to that.
Yeah, I mean, I on our new record, there's a lot of, there's a lot of subtle ideas, or even more explicit ideas, of just kind of longing for a new earth and heaven. And I think that, what you guys are talking about is that tension that we live in right now as Christians with sin, but being saved. And I just feel, well, I guess my hope is that all of that tension will make heaven so much more glorious to be freed from that, And when I think about the tension, it doesn't necessarily totally bum me out that I'm going to kind of live in this, already not yet state for the rest of my life, because I think it's just another thing that will be beautifully made whole at the end of my life.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, gonna go a little lighter here. So obviously, like we told you before the show started that this podcast kind of revolves around, a lot of it revolves around kind of like beer culture, craft beer culture. I'm a brewer.
Nice.
So my question for you is, do you drink alcohol, and if so, what is your drink of choice?
I do. I like whiskey more than beer.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I don't drink a lot. And I'll tell you why. It's because it's well, it depends on what time, you know, the season of my life that I'm in. But I have, in some seasons of my life, I have pretty severe anxiety disorder with panic attacks and stuff like that. And in those seasons, drinking for some reason doesn't help me as much. Even just a beer can help me make me feel a little weirder the following day. So, you know, most of my buddies drink regularly, just, you know, not getting drunk and stuff, but just for, like, you guys brewing and stuff. But I'm in a current season where I'm not really drinking that much alcohol, which is kind of sad because I have really nice whiskey sitting on my sitting on my kitchen right now, and I just give it to my friends when they come over.
Nice.
Yeah.
What kind of whiskey do you like?
I have some Lafroig right over here.
It's one of my favorites.
I think Eagle Rare is actually I really like.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I've got some Deanston over there. So, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, Lafroig is one of my favorite scotches, that and Lagavulin. I have a bottle of Lagavulin right now and a bottle of Lafroig quarter cask that are I haven't been drinking as much because I'm in med school, so I don't have a
wow. That's intense, man.
Yeah, I don't have the ability to really study all day, come home and drink and then still retain information. So
you say Lafroig? See, I'm learning right now. That's how I actually
supposed to say it. Yeah, apparently that's how you say it. That's how they say it. I've watched, I'm like a super geek with this kind of stuff. So I go on YouTube and I watched Lafroig. If you ever want to know like the amount of craftsmanship that goes into Scotch whiskey, there's a really good video on YouTube where the head, I don't know what you call him, distiller, I guess, of Lafroig, kind of walks you through the whole process of how they make it, and they've been doing it for, you know, since the 1800s, I think. I think it's the 1800s.
That sounds awesome. So,
yeah, it's really cool, man. Like the, I mean, I brew and I watch this, and I'm like, there's no way that I could ever do this. It's the craftsmanship is incredible. It's definitely something that is pretty amazing that people are capable of doing. So.
That's pretty really cool. I had moonshine for the first time this year, and I went to a distillery for that, and that was pretty wild. Watching them do that.
Moonshine is a whole nother world.
It's totally different world.
It's really cool though that they. I mean, and those guys are doing it with like just antiquated like stuff from the way they've been doing it for, you know, since like the 1600s. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know that. So you left Mars Hill. How long ago was that? That you left Mars Hill?
Last November or last December was when I stopped. Yep, last December.
And it's been a while. So even since probably since you left, you've probably seen like just crazy things blowing up in the news ever since then. Which is, it's very unfortunate. And, we have like a Facebook group of all, you know, all the reformed young reformed guys that have been following Mars Hill for a long time. Mm. And, you know, so we sort of feel that and we crack jokes about it and stuff on the show. But you know, obviously somebody who's been through it, I just wonder if you can give some advice to people, because I know, you know, so we're reformed and we take church very seriously and we don't want to be church hoppers. We don't want to be just like bailing out every time the slightest problem happens and stuff like that.
Right.
So when like, how do you, as someone who is in a position of leadership and in a pretty, you know, well-off church, successful church, I guess, or, you know, whatever, however you want to call it. How do you make the decision that it's, you know, it's really just time to leave this? And even if there's going to be repercussions, which I, from what I understand, there were.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I just had to pray about it a ton. And there was enough information on the table to make you know, decisions. But, you know, at the end of the day, I have friends that are still pastors there that haven't left yet, and it's still the right decision for them because that's what, you know, the Holy Spirit's having them do. And I think I was on the kind of the earlier wave of people that were leaving. I think I left before the rest of the music guys from Marso Music did. It's really, really, it was just like, God, what do you want me to do? It's fine to do ministry in Babylon, you know, like,
yeah.
And that's at the time, that's what it felt like. And it probably still feels like that for a lot of people that are there right now. And I think that's a fair thing to say. But you have to be called to it. And at the time, and still now, you know, that's not what God, has for me. And that's not where he wanted me to walk. So, you know, really, I can't say to somebody now that's still, you know, holding on and holding out there, like, hey, you need to leave. But I would, especially if it was a close friend, you know, be curious to know why they were staying around and, you know, share my story with them and stuff like that. So, yeah.
So it was probably a time of a lot of uncertainty for you. Were you was that your job? Were you like paid staff?
Yeah. I'd been on staff for, I think for 4 years. And my wife was on staff too, actually. That's how met. We helped plant the U District Church, which actually just closed, which has, been really, really sad for us. Mm. But yeah, we got to help plant that church. That's where we met. And then, after we got married, I moved over to the Ballard campus, which was at the time the big one before they moved things over to a different campus called Bellevue, in a more of a suburban area. But yeah, so it was a very hard decision because not only were we deciding, hey, we're going to leave both of our jobs and what God has called us to. And, you know, for me as well, like I grew up, in a suburb outside of Seattle, like visiting Mars Hill since I was like 15, you know, and every once in a while. And I grew a lot from it. I learned a ton from Mark. I think I formed a lot of like my systematic theology and learned about, you know, Grudem and stuff through him. And then it was just like, we're leaving our community, our church family, and two jobs all at the same time. It literally felt like God was just saying, hey, step out, you know, towards me. Like, I'm out on the water. Just take a step. You're going to be all right. And we didn't have a plan. That's the other thing, is everybody was like, well, you know, where are you going to go work? What church are you going to go to? Are you going to go lead worship somewhere else? Are you on staff somewhere else? Are you going to, you know, and we just were like, no idea. We don't know. So, it was a very, very large, sort of step of faith. And, God has been exceedingly faithful this whole year in every way to us. Mm. Even through, you know, more trials after that one, but it was very, very hard, very difficult. For sure.
Wow. King's Kaleidoscope actually formed in Mars Hill, or?
Yeah. When I was an intern, before I came on staff, while we were planting the church in the U District, we were on the campus of the University of Washington in a lecture hall. I started leading, and that's kind of when the band formed. And then later, like the next year, I came on staff. And we got a building and stuff like that. But that was, those were just fun days. Like that whole church was super formative for me in how I understand how church can be run. And it was like, I mean, it was just seriously the wild, wild west. Like, we had, you know, the the lead pastor was, I think, 26 or 27. And wow. I was 22. And so I was the worship, you know, leader. And all the rest of the staff was in between our ages and interns younger than me. And I lived in the church like freaking Quasimodo or something. Like, I lived, there was an apartment like up above the sanctuary.
Whoa.
And I lived up there with a few other guys. And, you know, I mean, it was literally like, and a bunch of the staff was just raising their own support as missionaries. And, you know, we were just ministering to like the Greek system there and starting a lot of community groups. And yeah, it was just wild to be this group of such young people that were so passionate about college students meeting Jesus. And we had the backing and the resources of like a mega church.
Wow. You
know? And it was like, go do it. And we, you know, we did. And it was, yeah, it's one of those things where there'll never be another thing like that again in my whole life, probably. I'm sure, you know, there'll be other, you know, exciting seasons, but I'm just really thankful for it. And it definitely probably formed me in ways I'm still figuring out, but it was amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. It was cool. That's so cool, man.
I wanted to ask about, I don't know, like kind of your journey into getting into music. I was, you know, when I was, I don't know, high school, I started playing music when I was, I guess, in elementary school. I joined band and whatnot. And then I got into bands when I was like in middle school, high school. And I spent a time of my life where I was playing in secular bands and kind of like trying to, you know, become a rock star and that kind of stuff. And I was just curious. I feel like a lot of people I've talked to that have gotten, either into, you know, doing, you know, leading worship and whatnot, might have gone through a similar phase. Did you ever have a phase in your life where you were like in bands or producing music that was secular and then like God called you to, I mean, obviously a greater calling?
Mm-hmm. I grew up in a really musical family. You know, my uncle is like a very well-respected choir director in Seattle, and does a lot of the music directing at a pretty big cathedral, actually. And, you know, my siblings and I all were forced to take piano lessons when we were 5 years old, and I hated it. And then I just always wanted to play drums. And so soon afterwards, I did my 5 years, and as soon as they were done, I just was begging for drumsticks, picked up drums. But you know, my parents were musical and they were really active in their church. So I did grow up playing a lot in church. I played drums. My dad played bass. And so I would go to rehearsals with him all the time. But my first kind of like experience of just doing music kind of just for me was I started producing hip hop music in middle school, and I became a DJ. And I would say like elementary school, I pretty much listened to Christian music, you know, or whatever my parents were listening to. And then like middle school was kind of where I found the, you know, the like the Seattle's like rap hip hop station. And I was like really like turned on to just like Tupac and whatever else was like popular then.
Yeah.
And I had never heard anything or Jay-Z. Like I hadn't heard anything like that. And that, you know, it was vulgar at times and stuff like that, but it was more about like musically it just made me really excited and I wanted to reproduce that. So in middle school all the way through high school, I was always DJing my high school or middle school dances. I kind of like had this business. So I never had a high school job outside of DJing, which was actually awesome because it was like, I was able to like, you know, make a good amount of money as a kid. I didn't have them that often, but when I did, it felt awesome, you know, to get like $100 for playing music for a party.
And you were like probably one of like the coolest guys because you're like the DJ.
You know, kind of. I've always played this weird role where I think I'm actually an introvert, but I'm kind of a verbal processor, and I'm a musician, so I'm always in front of people. So it was this kind of weird thing where, yeah, like people would think like, wow, this guy's really cool. He's a DJ and stuff like that. But I wasn't necessarily like, you know, going to everybody's parties and invited over to everybody's house and stuff like that. Cause I was also this, you know, I was a Christian and my parents had like this farm, and it was just a weird situation kind of growing up. But yeah, I started, you know, I was playing in youth group at the same time as I was trying to run my own band come high school. And, you know, my own band, even at that time, had like, I would say like I was writing kind of religious themes and stuff like that. But you know, honestly, I always wanted to lead worship, and I always really had a desire to make respectable art within the category of like, this is gospel music. And I felt growing up that as soon as something was Christian or, you know, or made for the church, it basically became like bad art, and not because it needed to, but just because like that's the way the industry was working. And I always kind of really hated that. And actually Mars Hill was the first place that like I would go to and hear whatever, you know, punk bands they were having at that time play. And I was just like, oh my gosh, like I can't imagine. I just couldn't believe that there was something that was like culturally relevant and current, and it was like these guys were just doing whatever they loved, but it was for the church. That like blew me away, you know. Yeah. And it wasn't as singable as Chris Tomlin or whatever like that, but it was like, it was awesome, and it really inspired me, and I wanted to do that. And then it kind of, you know, blew my mind when, you know, 5 years later, when I was 21 and I was leading at Mars Hill, and it was like, it was like kind of crazy for me growing up under that. And so I would say I think that more than ever, like I want to be a rock star. It still is constantly for my identity a battle of, you know, is my value coming from what I can produce and who, you know, who I can impress, or is my value coming from, you know, what God says of me, which is that I'm his son. And I think that that's always a battle for most artists. And, you know, so yeah, I would say it was less of like a phase that then like I got snapped out of and was like, no, I'm just going to serve the church. And it was more just kind of like, I kind of want to make, you know, just really good art that encourages the church, that blesses the church, whether that's just in the format of a band or that's the format of leading worship on, you know, to a congregation on Sundays. And that's what I've been doing. But yeah, it's kind of been more of a ongoing thing that there's always a temptation to make your work your identity, I think, for people, and definitely for me.
So that works really well into a question I was going to ask, and this comes to us from my buddy Steven Schmidt, who might be your biggest fan on the planet.
Awesome.
We hear a lot about the regulative principle and stuff like that, so I'm always curious about bands' philosophies when it comes to music and like what exactly music is to the church and stuff like that. So this question from Steven is... with King's Kaleidoscope no longer being a church band, what is your vision or your purpose now? And do you have congregational worship in mind, or do you just want to jam?
It's a great question. I would say I'm still praying through and figuring that out to a large extent of like, God, what do you want to have happen with us down the road? I'll tell you one thing that I'm not as excited about is, and I'm not saying I'm opposed to it by any means, but you know, Kings, we really were born and crafted for a particular church in a particular place. You know, like,
yeah,
we were made to serve a college church in Seattle. And that's very specific, you know. It very specifically informed the style of music that we were able to do. It very specifically informed the amount of creative liberty we had because we were in a like progressive city, and that was I hate the word missional sometimes, but that's like it spoke their language, and so. You know, and then even later when we were at Ballard, it was the same thing. You know, Ballard is a very trendy neighborhood in Seattle, and it was easy to serve that neighborhood with what we were doing. And so since, you know, just, and we're figuring this out, but in the last 8 months, since we haven't been leading worship in those areas, it's been kind of a learning experience of like, well, if you craft something and you make something to serve a particular people, if you're speaking a particular subculture's language, what happens when you just take that and you go somewhere else in the country? You know, what happens when you take that to somebody that, or to a group of people that has their only experience with worship music is, you know, whatever's mainstream currently, Hillsong or whatever.
Yeah.
And so for myself personally, I don't have a problem with leading worship for conferences or stuff like that, because there's, you know, worship bands are needed. But there's a part of me that almost feels like it's a disservice when I know that 80% of those people have never heard anything like King's Kaleidoscope. I don't want to like distract them with all of our like bonkers, you know, arrangements or whatever, because yeah. I know that we pushed the boundary, because that's like what I get excited about, but that was totally fine for our church. But when I, you know, if I'm going to go to Texas and like just pull up with King's Kaleidoscope and lead conference for worship, it's like, that is a great thing to do, but it's almost like I would rather like sort of try to figure out who I'm going to be serving and serve them well. And so when we think about this record that we're putting out and we think about, you know, how is it going to serve the church? We have a lot of songs that we were doing at Mars Hill, like some hymns and stuff like that. But with the new songs that we were writing, we weren't writing them for a particular church group anymore. We were just writing them as just like personal experiences and just poetry and, you know, just different like ideas that we were getting excited about. And I think that still, I hope, will build up the church. Because I think with a lot of recorded worship music, it's like, you know, when you make something for a congregational like participation, it's has to be simplified to a large extent, because you have 1,000 people and they're from all over and they've got to sing it together. Which doesn't necessarily make for the best recorded music, because then when you just want to listen to something in your car, you know, how long are you going to want to listen to that for if it's so simple? For me personally, that's the way I feel about it. So our new record definitely is less congregational, I would say, and I would say like, when you know, the events that we're going to try to do coming up. Man, when we get opportunities to go lead worship, I'm thankful for them, and I really want to go in not as like King's Kaleidoscope galore with like all the like bells and whistles, but like how do we serve those people individually? But as far as the record we've just made, it's much more like I'm really excited to start playing some concerts and shows that are highly inspiring and just like, I guess just spiritual would be a good word for them, you know, like almost like I was going to this concert to be entertained by this really good band, and man, they're just like worshiping on the spot, and it really is inspiring me and encouraging me. Like that's kind of how I'm feeling, but it puts us in a weird place, because it's, you know, our labels and stuff is like, well, how do we market them? Like we can't really pair them with this worship scene necessarily. We could, but half their songs don't make any sense in that scene now. But we can't necessarily pair them in a like just an alternative scene because it's too like it's too gospely and you know theological or it's too much about Jesus. So you know we're kind of running in our own lane right now, which is scary and exciting at the same time. That's a long answer, but that's kind of where we're at currently.
Yeah, it seems like that you, I think most artists in this kind of this genre, I guess you could call it or whatever, either go, like, I guess they have three choices. Like, they can either go, you know, full praise and worship, or they can be mm-hmm. like a Christian rock band where they play mostly concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can release albums that are praise and worship, but also do... also do like their own thing where they're kind of like exploring their creativity vein and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like, you know, that you guys are trying to say, well, like, no, forget that. Like, I'm not going to choose one or the other. We're going to do yeah. both. And that's, yeah, I mean, it's a good way to avoid living a double life as a musician. But, in the same sense, I hear what you're saying where it is a challenge to, you know, play in situations where people are going to be singing along and whatnot.
That's another thing that I'm just continually curious about is, like the church's view of like congregational is so different from the mainstream's view of congregational. Like when I saw Justin Timberlake this year, like that was probably the most congregational event I've been to in a long time. Like
wow.
He played for 3 hours with a 10-minute break, no opening band, 20,000 people in a stadium, and everybody was standing the entire time and they were all engaged and like singing and clapping and dancing along. And I was like, okay, but do you know how like hard some of his songs are to sing? Right? Huh. But like when you
he's amazing. Don't
right,
yeah.
right.
But I like totally
when,
yeah,
when you think it. About I a church it. Though, you think about like, well, you know, that key is just too high. Or, you know, like, oh, that those lyrics are too fast. And so right. It's like, what is congregational, you know? And also like just how I feel like the whole, the definition of worship has been greatly clarified a lot. I've seen it over and over and over again, like in the past couple of years where just people will say, You know, worship isn't just on Sunday mornings. Like all of life is worship. You know, it's a hose without you can't turn off, and it just depends yeah. on where you direct your worship. Okay, if we actually believe that, then there's nothing more worshipful about singing on Sunday mornings than, you know, cleaning your house. It's just a matter of your heart being in the right place, and so there's a focus. And there's a congregational aspect that's needed. I'm not discounting that at all. But what I am saying is like, for a Christian band to be encouraging people with a concert, I think is just as legit as if they decide to lead worship on Sunday morning. Because they are leading worship, you know? In fact, if they're being examples and pointing to Jesus, I think it's pretty awesome. Because in a lot of senses, they have more influence than a worship leader on a Sunday morning. And so I don't know, that's just off the top of my head, but I'm constantly just thinking about that and thinking like, who are the biggest worship leaders in the world right now? Kanye West is probably one of them.
Yeah.
Because people just do whatever he says. Like,
I don't understand that. Don't get me started on Kanye West, man. I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his as an artist and as a thinker and musically, but I can't, you know, get behind everything he says in his lyrics, but I think he just pulls a lot of weight. And I think it's just interesting, if anything, to look at that and go, okay, at the end of the day, he's actually leading worship. He's leading people to worship sex. He's leading people to worship money. He's leading people to worship fame. And he's doing it way more effectively than a lot of, you know, church worship leaders.
Yeah.
Like, what is he doing differently? And I think that there's a piece of it that's authenticity. I think that there's a piece of it that is beauty. I know that sounds weird for me to say Kanye West makes beautiful music, but I actually think people who understand rap music and hip hop and the history of it would look at him and go, yeah, it's really beautiful. It's honest. It's personal. And I think that we just miss a lot of that in church music often, by just trying to say, well, it's, you know, it's easy or it's traditional. And it's like, well, yeah, but like, it's just as worshipful for somebody to image God as a creative God and be creative and write a beautiful song because they're being who he created them to be. And, so yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we want to do is just like, who did God create us to be? Well, he created us creators, and maybe he's just as happy if we just created something than if we led worship. And if we did it out of a worshipful heart, you know, it's not necessarily one's greater than the other, but we still love the church. You know, we still want to serve him. That's the, you know,
do you find it more difficult? I mean, I guess the answer to this might be obvious, but, more difficult to sort of, I don't know, I guess repurpose hymns and re-explain truths, before a congregation and the things that you were doing at Mars Hill, as opposed to now where you're actually writing your own lyrics and writing your own melodies and all that stuff from scratch and right out of your brain.
Yeah, it's way easier to, partially that's just the way that, partially I think that's just like what, I'm a terrible lyricist. maybe I should give myself a little credit. I'm not terrible. I'm bad. I'm not quick. It takes me a long time. This is the first time I've ever really like written my own lyrics. And to me, the thing that's easy and fun is arranging. Like I can arrange all day long. I can produce stuff all day long. So for me, that was always I would say this, it actually got to a point where I was pretty, like bored because I felt like I wasn't, I felt like the thing that I love most about being in a church and serving a church is the discipleship and the shepherding of like the flock and of like the bands that I was working with and the people. That is what makes me really excited. But, musically, I think I got to a place where it was like, man, we have songs that, you know, and there was a bunch of worship leaders. So there was a lot of decisions I didn't have to make. And there was a lot of other work that was already being done that I didn't always have to do. My job was just to kind of lead on Sundays and arrange stuff, which felt a little bit like I wasn't having to depend on God for nearly as much. And now it feels like, holy smokes, I don't just have a catalog of like 30 songs that I know are good that I just get to pick from and arrange. It's like, it's scary to just think of like just being yourself and how to worship God by just being yourself without having something handed to you. And I don't know if that makes sense, but it's just kind of like, man, if I don't have like a goal to conquer necessarily, it almost takes more faith to believe that I could just sit at home and play my guitar and that Jesus would love me just as much as if I like did a really good job leading worship on Sunday.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm at right now is like, well, what if I wrote a song like I have a song on a record that's kind of trippy. It's called Dreams. And it's just about, it's roughly based off of a dream I had where, the Holy Spirit, like I've never had anything like this in my life, but I had this really trippy, like psychedelic dream. And at the end of it, God just was, I felt so strongly that he just loved me. And I just felt over and over again that I was loved. And I woke up like crying and that was it. Jeez. And I was like, how do you write a song about that? Well, it's not a congregational song at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's a really cool song that's on our record. And I look at it and I go, well, you know, maybe people are going to look at this and read the lyrics and go, well, that's not theologically accurate. You know, when I say like, once in a while, I close my eyes, drifting to sleep, you come alive. I'm talking about, you know, God's like, you know, felt presence. It's somebody's going to go, God doesn't come alive when you go to sleep. You know, like,
right.
But it's kind of like, I'm okay with somebody saying that. Like you know, it takes more faith for me to like put myself out there and be a vulnerable human being that is trusting that, you know, God loves me by just being a kid that's making art for him and just doing what he made me to do, than necessarily following, you know, best practices. And there's so much structure with the church that it can be a little bit of a false security, I think. At least it was for me.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, man. Like that, while you were talking about that, it made me think about a conversation that Les and I had recently about basically, you know, people who aren't involved in maybe direct ministry, like they're not pastors or elders or they're not worship leaders.
Right.
You know, I think there is like this idea that, you know, the people who are preaching on Sunday morning or their missionaries or their worship leaders have maybe a, I don't know if greater calling, or they're doing more for the kingdom. And while you were talking about that, I was thinking, cause like, you know, as you know, I'm in med school and I think a lot, like lately I've been thinking a lot, like how, you know, how do I, you know, bring glory to God through what I'm going to do, and how do I make an impact in what I'm going to do? How do I integrate my love for the Lord and in my job and the thing that I have passion for? And, you know, I think that it's important to talk about these things. Like now you're pursuing this area where you're creating, you know, partially for the sake of creating because you enjoy it and God's given you a passion for it. But in the same sense, I think there's a lot of people who would look at it and say, well, you know, when you were a worship leader, you know, you were leading all these people to worship and whatnot, and people can discount how somebody looking at you and seeing you these God-given gifts that you've had and that He's given you, and this passion that you have for it, and the fact that you're glorifying God through it, and worshiping Him for just giving you these talents and giving you this enjoyment of being able to do what you do. You know, I think that that's something that people maybe just don't talk about enough and don't recognize enough. And I don't know. I think it's definitely something that's important to think about and talk about. And as Christians, we're not all called to, you know, to preach on Sunday morning. We're not all called to lead worship, you know. So it's important that there is a voice out there for people who are just doing what God has called them to do and doing it to the glory of Him. And I don't know, I think it's something that we, you know, we have to contemplate on, and how we can bring worship into our workplaces or in whatever passion God's given us. So, that's really cool.
I think that's just so important, especially when you just look at like how many, you know, like we're all the church, including the pastor. We're God's like capital C church. And, you know, I just think I'm at the season that I'm at right now, at least with the way I view life and what I'm trying to focus on is just being like, if I, you know, like God, you know, maybe a lot of my passion in the past has been selfish and I didn't even know it, you know, like you don't need me to like convert Seattle or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, or like, what if I just focused my time on not necessarily like everything that I could produce and be productive with, but what if I just focused my heart and my time on like prayer and on, like, I guess another way to say what I'm trying to say is like, when I die, I don't necessarily want people to remember me by all the stuff that I did and all the stuff I made. I'd rather be remembered by like, you know, Chad was like, he loved people, or Chad, you know, was humble or something like that. All those things that I'm like far from accomplishing and I never will get fully there. But like, I guess there's just so much of the, like the Christian, like evangelical, like, conquest for Jesus stuff is really good at sometimes, and then other times just like, dude, like God's gonna save people, you know, like it's okay. You don't have to like take over the world just because you're 18 and you like, you know, went on a mission trip Like, you got plenty of stuff to grow with, man. You can be patient, you know, and you can just be yourself. So,
and God uses ordinary things and ordinary lives.
He's the one making it happen anyways, you know? Just like, yeah, totally.
Yeah. It's funny because you hear in church all the time, I feel like it's like every other Sunday I hear, you know, like, let's, you know, they're calling the church to get out and like save their community.
Right.
And I feel like that there's such, like, there's neglect to recognize, like recently I was like reading through Colossians, and where Paul talks about, like, he says, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men.
Mm.
And I feel like there's like this missing gap where there's not this talk about, like, when we say, like, let's go out and make an impact in our community, like, let's get down to brass tacks and talk about how, like, why don't you just go to work and put a smile on your face and be joyful and be happy for the talents that God's given you and the provision that he's giving you through your job or your passions or whatever it is, mm-hmm. and work heartily for the Lord. And in that, you know, I'm not saying, like, just keep your mouth shut and not say anything about Jesus, because obviously we know that, you know, faith comes from hearing.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But I think that it's, if you're at work or you're doing your hobbies even, and you have like a scowl and you're not joyful about what God's doing in your life and what you're doing and the passions that he's given you, then what kind of, like, when you start to talk about the gospel and when you start to share about Jesus, how is the person listening to you going to relate, like, this amazing joy that you're talking about, like being delivered from death, mm-hmm. like you have completely been died to this curse that you had, and now you've been risen with Christ, and you're talking out of both sides of your mouth, because you just came from a point where people notice when you're miserable, people notice when you don't have joy. And I think that, you know, you have to start from the basics, which is just, you know, have joy in what you do and just work heartily for the Lord and put a smile on your face. And then when you do preach the gospel, people are going to, when you're talking about it, they're going to be like, yeah, I see that joy in you. I see that there's, you don't get your worth from the world, from things that come from the world. Your worth is something higher, and it's, I think that's super important, man. I think we have to enjoy what we do, and even if we're in a state where we're not doing what we necessarily want to be doing, we have to see it as something that God's called us to, and put a smile on our face so that we're not, you know, talking out of both sides of our mouth.
Hmm.
Amen. Hmm. All right, we're going to very abruptly shift gears.
All right. So
we're going to play a very, very silly, silly game, but it's really fun if you sort of get into it. So we're going to play a game that we play on the show pretty much every week called Would You Rather. Tanner, would you like to explain to Chad how Would You Rather works?
I'm not good at explaining it. You explain it much better. Okay. Go ahead.
I'll explain it. So this is how it works. We are going to offer up to you two would you rather scenarios. So once you have them, we will open the floor for questions, and then it's up to you to garner as much information as you can about these situations, these scenarios that you would live in an alternate reality.
Okay.
To find out which one seems more appealing to you. Neither of them are going to be ideal, but okay. Basically, which one is less terrible?
I love it.
Okay, good.
Less terrible.
Basically, yeah.
Yikes.
All right. So this Would You Rather comes to us from the gentleman who introduced me to King's Kaleidoscope probably 3 years ago.
All right.
His name is Josh Mullen. He's an awesome friend. He might also be your number one fan. So Josh asks, would you rather have an extra mouth that you have no control over?
Oh my gosh.
Let that set in for a second.
Okay.
Or every time you sneeze, you adopt a pet moose.
Okay, I love it. Those are good options, actually.
Now, we're opening the floor for questions.
Where's the mouth?
That's a really good question. Tanner, would you like to choose?
The mouth is it's in the center of your chest.
Oh. And you can't control it.
Right. You cannot control the mouth.
Every time I sneeze, I get a moose. Where did the moose pop up?
The moose pops up somewhere on within the property lines of what you own. Okay. So if I don't know where you live, do you live in an apartment or like a?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so
I live in like a loft apartment, so it's tall enough for a moose. But
do you have like bedrooms at all?
Yes.
You got like one bedroom?
Just one. Yeah.
Yeah, it's rough. Yeah. So well, it's gonna pop up. It just randomly pops up somewhere within where you the land that you own, which is in your case this apartment.
Okay. Is it a male moose or a female moose, or is it alternate?
They
or random.
That it's random. When it is a female moose, be aware that the female moose is always in heat.
Whoa.
So if there's any male moose around, it's gonna get a little crazy. And if there's okay. two male moose around, mooses, I don't know how to do the plural.
I think it's meese.
Meese? Okay.
Is it
if there's male meese, it's not meese, but it's fine. We'll go with meese. If there's male meese, they are going. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen this. This is like National Geographic, like platinum, like footage. Meese fighting over a female. This is going to be going on in your living room. They're going to be like straight up, like horns going at it for this female.
Okay, I got the next question.
Okay,
does my decision go into effect as soon as I decide, or do I have like a time? Like, will it happen next month? Will it happen at Christmas? Like, when will this happen?
Yeah, I'm looking at both options. Yeah, these are going to happen when you wake up in the morning tomorrow.
Ooh, yikes. Okay. Well, so far my thought process is I could probably just make a muzzle for the mouth, like a strap-on muzzle.
For the moose?
No, for the mouth.
Oh, the mouth on your chest.
Like, basically to keep it from yelling at people or, like, cussing. Like,
well, hold on. You haven't asked about what the mouth could have.
What's the demeanor?
The mouth could have great theology. It could have a great voice. I mean, it could be a backup singer for your band.
I can't control it though.
You need to inquire about the mouth a little bit more.
Okay. 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 Yeah. Okay. 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 Yeah. Like, what's the personality of the mouth?
It's an Arminian. It's an Arminian mouth. The mouth is very, now listen, the mouth is very, it is a very polite mouth, but the theology is terrible. And it's okay. constantly like altar calling while you're doing like it's like you're in the middle of leading worship and it's like right in the middle of a break of a song, it starts calling people to the front. And so people are like really confused. Oh, they don't understand what's going on. So you got to deal with that. Can it beatbox? Les,
is that to me?
That's to you.
It definitely can. But you have to make it happy in order for it to do things like that, which you totally can.
Does it know how to play guitar with its tongue?
Sure. Sure. Well, yeah, I'll give you that. It's fine.
Okay. But it's a loudmouth, nice Arminian that can beatbox.
It sometimes puts a little prosperity in there. I mean, it's got bad theology. Mm-hmm. All over the place.
So I would definitely have to figure out how to get a muzzle for it or something. I'm just thinking like Iron Man with a mouth and he's got to like, you know, wrap it or something like that. Okay. So if tomorrow, and then the other thing is like, if I think about the moose thing, I have allergies. So that's a lot of moose or meese or whatever we're calling them.
Are you allergic to meese?
Oh, probably. But the thing is, you know, that could be a pretty successful business if I had a bunch of property that I lived on. Because you said within the lines of my property. So maybe if I could find like an island or something, you know, I could sell moose to whoever needs them. Or I could run like a hunting island where it's just moose everywhere.
Yeah.
That's my idea right now. Is like, basically I could have my own island that would always produce meese, and then I could just charge people to come shoot them and take them home, and there'd always be plenty of them. So like, I could just basically, I don't know where that would be a successful business. Anywhere there's hunters.
Let me sweeten the pot of the extra mouth for a second.
Okay.
This mouth has absolutely perfect pitch. Okay. It is literally the greatest opera singer that has ever existed. So if you can somehow figure
Arminian,
out a way.
It's Arminian opera, though. Les.
Yes,
Arminian,
it is
Arminian opera.
So he will not sing any of your lyrics that have Reformed theology in them, unfortunately. But if you can manipulate this mouth to do your bidding, it will be groundbreaking in the music industry.
Okay, because I could probably like learn enough to sing some harmonies with it, operatic style, and we could maybe go to New York and make some money. Is what you're saying?
Yeah. But in the media, he's really going to be pushing unlimited atonement.
I think I'm going to have to go with the
wait. You can't answer until we close the floor.
Les has got to close the floor.
Sorry.
Les has got to close the floor.
Do you have any more questions?
Oh, man. How long do the moose live?
Ooh, that's a good question. Tanner, go ahead. Go for it.
They live just a normal moose life.
Which is,
that's a great question, Les. I don't know. What is a moose? I don't know. Maybe I imagine a moose probably lives like what, 20, 30 years?
Yeah. Once it gets like past like 10 or 15 years, it really doesn't matter at that point. It's a pretty permanent fixture in your home.
What age are they when they appear?
Ooh.
Les, that's you, man.
They're puppy meese.
Okay.
So they're cute at first, which is a plus.
Okay. So you said they're cute and they're horny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like teenage meese.
Ugh. Teenage meese are the grossest. That's the worst time in life. Like when you're a teenage moose and you got all the hormones going, you know, for the first time, you don't really know
what. You don't have your antlers.
There's
yet,
like moose acne everywhere.
Ugh. It's disgusting. Gross. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the floor for questions. Chad Gardner, would you rather have an extra mouth that you have no control over, or every time you sneeze, you adopt a pet moose?
I'm going to take the moose. I'm going to take the moose. I'm going to buy an island.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm going to open up a hunting moose. A
hunting camp.
Camp. Yeah. Where there's just moose everywhere and you can, you know, it'll be cheap prices because as much as I sneeze, I just make more money.
It's gonna be a popular destination for hunters. I think you got a good business going.
I don't know. You know, I haven't seen your bank records, but I'm kind of wondering about the ability to buy an island.
Yeah, zero, no ability at all. I'm looking for an investor. So if you guys know anybody,
hey,
excellent.
Yeah,
awesome.
This is a business idea I'd have to pitch to somebody else.
You could do it. You could start a Kickstarter. I'm sure.
Yeah,
work
right.
Out.
Yeah, right. It kind of sounds like Jurassic Park a little bit for some reason to me.
There's a movie there.
Just like
sure.
This exotic moose island. Yeah.
That is the worst movie I've ever seen. Chad, tell us about how people can get your new album.
Everywhere. It's going to be in some stores. I actually don't know which ones. Christian stores, probably. You might find it at Best Buy. We'll see. But iTunes, you can just go to our website, kingskaleidoscope.com, and pick it up there as well. And for the people that want something fancy, we're selling vinyl there also.
Oh, man.
Ooh, I love my vinyl.
Dude, these albums look amazing. The vinyl albums. Tanner, you gotta get it.
I gotta
I'm
get
excited.
It. Gotta get it.
So this is your first LP, Becoming Who We Are?
It is. We've done four EPs, and this is kind of our first one. We've self-produced it. You know, we we kind of self-funded it by playing some shows and doing a pre-order, and yeah, it feels pretty incredible, actually.
That's so awesome. Well, if you would like to contact us, you can join our Facebook group called The Reformed Pub. You can follow us on Twitter at Reformed Pubcast. You can email us reformedpub@gmail.com, and you can always leave us voicemails by calling 772-405-7327. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Reformed Pubcast. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed making it. Until next week, cheers and amen.
Every day at dusk, I chase the sunset, looking for a glimpse of heaven's skies. I've been given a taste for something that nothing in this world can satisfy. But I know that a time is coming when I will be in glorious delight. I know I will run through heaven's brilliant streets of gold, shouting hallelujah, Christ the Lord. I know I will dance and sing and bow before the throne. Yeah, this I know. Oh, oh. Every day at dawn, I chase the sunrise,